WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've met some remarkable people this year on Fresh Air. To close 1993, we've put together a retrospective featuring some of their interviews. Everyone we'll hear from today has risked their lives to report on or to help the people of Bosnia. NPR's Tom Jelton received a George Polk Award this year for his coverage of the war in Bosnia. Our interview with Jelton was recorded last April 16th on the first anniversary of the siege of Sarajevo. When we spoke, an estimated one out of every six residents of the city had been killed or wounded. We began with an excerpt of one of Jelton's reports from the summer of 1992, recorded in the home of Ivan and Gordana Knezevic. At the time, Ivan was a professor, Gordana an editor of the only Sarajevo newspaper still being published. Gordana was continuing to go to work at the paper in spite of the siege.
Gordana and Ivan and others in Sarajevo who stubbornly continue to go to work in the midst of artillery bombardment and sniper fire say they do so as a form of resistance. The enemy, Gordana says, is determined to bring life in Sarajevo to a halt. So, refusing to stop working, in Gordana's case, putting out a newspaper day after day, becomes a way of defying the relentless shooting. There have been days, Gordana says, when the only two things sold on the streets of Sarajevo were bread and her newspaper. But she finds it's becoming more difficult, not because it's any more dangerous to get to work. Rather, it's getting harder and harder just to think clearly. Gordana says she's losing the ability to analyze facts, to assess each day's developments, to look back and to look ahead.
I think that the worst part of it, that we lost any sense of time. And every day, I'm asking 10 times a day, which day is it today? And I can't remember which day in the week it is, and which date in the month it is, and I can't even remember which month it is. And if you want me to be very honest, I almost forgot which year is this. We lost any sense of seasons in the year, and we lost any sense of the future. I mean, I don't know when the spring was finished, and I don't know when the summer started. And there are only two seasons now. There is a war season, and somewhere in the world there is a peace season. Not for us here. No.
What do you think, Ivan?
Ne znam, nisam siguran. Šta izdvojit? Šta godi?
Maybe we should turn the light down.
At this explosion, we get up from the kitchen table and move to the next room, further from the windows.
No, I know when you were interviewing Gordana Knezevic, one of the things she said was that she was afraid she was losing her ability to think clearly, and she's a journalist. She's an editor at that Sarajevo newspaper. Has that ever been a problem for you when you've been there for extended periods of time, or do you feel you haven't been there long enough to have that kind of feeling?
It is a problem. It's a very emotional experience to be in Sarajevo. First, you're in danger, just like everyone else is, and therefore, unlike a lot of news stories where the reporter can more or less remain dispassionate, it's much harder in Sarajevo to be detached from the story because you become, even for a limited period, as much a target of attacks and as much a victim, in a sense, as they are. And so you begin to identify with them. And therefore, when you go to write your articles or file your reports, you have to really be careful not to sort of let them turn into a kind of an emotional diatribe or something like that. And I think that some stories that I have seen coming out of Sarajevo have sort of slipped beyond that line, and a reporter gets so worked up and passionate and emotional about the situation that he's in that the reporting suffers. And it's very difficult for me to talk to my editors when I'm there. I file on a satellite phone. It's very expensive. It's up to $40 a minute, and you can't have the kind of give and take with your editors that that I would normally have in a story like that. So, you know, editors can sort of keep you under control. They can say, back off, this is a little bit too much. And when you just have to file your stories and you don't have the chance to sort of play them for an editor first, there is that danger. You have to, one has to be very careful to keep his emotions under control as much as possible. And it's hard.
I've heard several journalists say that this war is a particularly dangerous war to cover. Now, you've covered wars in El Salvador, the war in the Gulf. What precautions do you take when you're reporting from Bosnia that are different from the precautions that you took when you were reporting from Central America?
Well, I never had protective clothing in Central America. I wear this huge and very heavy bulletproof vest in Bosnia, and a lot of reporters have helmets. I don't personally have a helmet yet because I think there's some... If you wear a helmet, you look too much like a soldier. So I'm not sure that that's a good idea. There were no armored cars in Central America. So those sort of minimum protection measures are taken in Bosnia that were not taken in other wars generally. But there's not a lot you can do. You just have to be far more careful about where you go, and you pay more attention to... On days, for example, in Sarajevo, when there's a lot of shelling, I basically stay in my hotel room. I just don't go out.
Well, I'm sure you've learned to recognize the sound of incoming shells and other weapons. What do you do when you hear one starting to whistle by?
Well, once if you hear one whistling by, you're okay. It means it's already gone by. The ones you have to worry about are the ones you don't hear. They do sometimes come in sequence. So if something explodes close by you, or if you hear something whistling by you, you try to take shelter. It's, you know, it's just, it's a difficult thing. There was a time when I was at the Bosnian Presidency building when a shell landed in front of the building on a group of people, and about a dozen people were injured and several people were killed. And I was inside the building and I could hear the screams from the people outside. And I thought to myself, this is the reality of this war. And as a journalist, I should describe this scene and I should even document it. And yet, I didn't go out there. I didn't go out there to see what had happened or to record the sounds of the scene because people around me were warning me not to. Often, as I say, the shells will come in sequence. And I think I might have described it in copy, but I didn't go out there in a circumstance. Some other journalists might have, but I actually tend to be very cautious in my movements.
Did you think it might have been voyeuristic, too, to have a microphone turned on so many people who are in agony?
Yes and no. I think one can certainly be discreet in a situation like that. You don't go up with a microphone, you know, and to someone who is in agony and record their sounds, but you can sort of stay at a distance and mm-hmm. just sort of make some kind of general recording just in order to provide a background in this of the scene. But that's not the reason I didn't do it, Terry, because I think that in that case, it would have been, I think it's really important that people understand how horrible this is. And I wouldn't have hesitated for that reason. One can do that with discretion. I hesitated because I thought it was too dangerous.
Well, it's important to do that. That way you're around to record the next thing that happens.
Right.
Is that the closest you've come to being hit yourself?
I had an experience last summer where I was driving. At that time, we still drove from the airport into the city in soft-skinned cars. I had my own car, and this was the day the airport was opened, put under UN control, and there were a convoy of us who were going back to the city together. Probably 8 or 10 press vehicles, and we came under fire on the road, and there were bullets whizzing all around. And the car behind me got hit, and I saw in my rearview mirror that they had been hit. And I started driving pretty wildly at that point. That's actually the closest that I ever came.
Who was in the car behind you that was hit?
It was a Viz News crew, which is a... They gather tape, videotape for a lot of television networks and sell it to television networks around the world. I think there might have been somebody from ITN, the British TV crew, in there as well. Fortunately, nobody was injured, but their windows were all blown out.
What effect does it have on your interest in continuing to report from Bosnia when someone who you know or someone physically close to you has been, injured or killed?
It has the effect of making me a lot more cautious. On that particular day, there were two journalists shot, and they were doing exactly what we were all doing. They were driving from the airport to the city, and I knew them. One was a reporter for Libération, the French newspaper. He was shot in the leg and ultimately lost his leg. With him was a photographer for The Observer, which is a London newspaper. I knew him a little better. He was kind of a cowboy type, full of bravado. And I went to see him in the hospital the next day. And he was curled up in his hospital bed in a fetal position. And was kind of, he was in a lot of pain and he was whimpering. And there was something about that experience that just sickened me. And, I think there are a lot of journalists who consider themselves invulnerable, and then they are just in a matter of moments reduced to this sort of whimpering mass in a hospital bed. And that really had a big impact on me. I didn't want to find myself in that situation. And I think there's a lot of stupidity, and I don't hesitate using that word, on the part of journalists in Sarajevo who kind of get off on the drama and risk of it without ever taking into consideration how much danger they're really in and how their lives will be permanently changed if they're not careful.
So this experience made you more cautious?
It certainly did.
Maybe a lot of people, too, are trying to make their reputation by doing something incredibly daring.
Yes. Another thing I noticed about that experience is that those two guys, the day before, we were a press pack. Everybody sort of travels together and gets together at night and goes out, or doesn't go out for dinner, but eats, together and maybe shares what they have. And there's a lot of camaraderie. And the day after that, these two guys are gone. They're just not there anymore. One is in the hospital, one is being evacuated, and nobody seems to notice. I mean, not that many people even went to see him in the hospital. And it was amazing to me how two people can just disappear from the press corps like that and no one seems to even take notice.
NPR foreign correspondent Tom Jelton recorded last April. Shortly after our interview, Tom Jelton returned to Sarajevo to begin work on a book about how the journalists of the city managed to keep publishing one newspaper in spite of the siege and what the struggle to keep the paper alive reveals about the larger struggles in Sarajevo. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Roy Gutman tells us about reporting on the death camps of Bosnia after this break. This is Fresh Air. The first lengthy accounts of the mass slaughter of prisoners in Bosnian concentration camps were written by Roy Gutman. In the summer of 1992, he reported that Serbs murdered about 3,000 Bosnians during 1 6-week period at the Brčko prison camp. Gutman won a Pulitzer Prize this year for what the judges described as courageous and persistent reporting that disclosed atrocities and other human rights violations in Croatia and Bosnia. Gutman is foreign correspondent for New York Newsday. His reports on the death camps of Bosnia were picked up by news media worldwide. In September, he told us how he investigated rumors of mass slaughter at the Omarska prison camp. Serbian authorities certainly wouldn't take a journalist on a tour of a death camp. So how do you track down people who can tell you the story, and how do you confirm it's true?
It was one of the most frustrating moments I could have imagined in life, because the story had the ring of authenticity to it, but I couldn't go there. I did the first obvious thing was to ask to go there.
You asked the Serbs if you could go.
Yes, yeah. I said I'd heard that the place, some terrible stories about it, and I just wanted to check them out.
And they said?
They said they couldn't guarantee my safety. So it was a way of saying, if you want to go, you may be a prisoner there yourself. And I just tried to think of what could I do to find evidence, to find, to bear out the stories, or whatever was going on in the camp. And for the first thing I did was I wrote a story about it. Now, ordinarily, one never writes a story based on hearsay, on a secondhand witness. But this somehow had the ring of authenticity to it. And so I said this was not a witness that Newsday had, that I had contacted, but that who had come to the Muslim authorities in Banja Luka. I contacted the International Red Cross. They also had picked up stories of this sort. I contacted the UN High Commission for Refugees, which had many people in the region. I contacted the European Community, who had monitors. I contacted the U.S. Embassy in Belgrade. And from all of these different international observers, I got a very strong impression that the story could well be true, but none of them could supply a witness. None of them had information that they thought was so airtight that they would give it to me. So after puzzling it over for a while, I came to the conclusion, with the guidance of my own editors, that I should go to wherever the biggest gathering point was for refugees from, for Muslim refugees from central Bosnia. And that happened to be Zagreb in Croatia, in neighboring Croatia at that time. They were arriving by the hundreds daily. They had no shelter to speak of. And I went there to the Muslim charity Merhamet, and I said, I want you to scour the refugee camps. I want you to find people for me who had been in Omarska. I'd heard by this point that a few people had gotten out, men over 65, boys under 16, that for some reason the Serb officials running the camp decided to let them out. So for, I don't know, 10 days or so, they searched. They found maybe a dozen witnesses for me from Omarska, and they found Mr. Lujinovic, who had been in Brčko, Luka. Of the dozen witnesses, really only two or three seemed either coherent or seemed credible. Most of them had stories, but they just didn't quite figure.
What was the minimum that you needed to go with this story in print?
Well, I decided in my own head I needed either two witnesses from the same camp or one witness from each of two camps. It was just an arbitrary rule. But I felt I needed at least a couple of stories. And then the second thing was I needed, I decided I had to have a picture of the witnesses because their stories were so extraordinary. Even if I couldn't use their names. And so that was the device we used in Newsday. We had their pictures on page one. And I think that alone drove it home, that these were real people and that they had a real story to tell.
Were your stories attacked for not being substantiated?
Oddly enough, they weren't. Because for one thing, just the fact of having the pictures made it clear that these were real people. Secondly, the story contained comments from every responsible international organization, including the Red Cross. The Red Cross had tried by this time to go to Omarska, for example, and they'd been denied admittance. And one of their spokesmen said to me, if this is not a death camp, then there's no reason the Serbs wouldn't allow us in.
Well, in fact, you say that the Serbs closed the Omarska camp after your Newsday report, and they dispersed the prisoners to other places. And then after that, they opened the camp to the Red Cross.
Yes, and to the press. You know, somebody in the Red Cross in Banja Luka told me that at a certain point, about 3 or 4 days after my story appeared, they saw trucks driving through Banja Luka full of bedding, of mattresses and bed frames. Heading toward Omarska. And this man, who was then the head of the Red Cross there, said, we think they're about to open up the Omarska camp. They had raided a hotel in Banja Luka to provide, to find beds, and they were transporting them to Omarska. They set them up in the basement of the administration building at this camp, and then invited in the press. And they told the press that this is where the prisoners slept, in this kind of Potemkin dormitory.
The Newsday headline that ran over your story about your first story about the mass executions in camps was "Death Camps of Bosnia." What did you think of that headline? What did you think of the use of the word "death camps"?
I thought it was accurate. I am more convinced now than ever that it was accurate. Mm-hmm. It was a very controversial headline because death camps from the period of the Nazi Holocaust are associated as, in most people's minds, as like Auschwitz, a factory where you take people and in an industrial method exterminate them. In the case of Omarska and Birchko, as from the passage I read earlier, and also from the evidence that's been gathered in the meantime, we can't say that these were factories, but that people were killed daily, arbitrarily, 10, 20, 50, 100 a day, mostly beaten. Some died of starvation. And that most of the people there would have died if they hadn't been freed by that point.
How graphic did you want your writing to be about the camps in Bosnia? I mean, in some of the articles, you have some fairly graphic descriptions of castrations, of the slitting of throats, of rape. And, I mean, there always is that question in photographs and in stories when you're describing something gruesome, how explicit to be.
I guess from my early days as a wire service reporter, I've always tried to observe the maxim of using no adjectives in my writing, or as few as possible. And basically to try to relate the substance is the most important thing, unadorned, straightforwardly. And I felt that that was the only way to be convincing, that it needed no embellishment, that the stories of the witnesses simply should be told as directly as possible.
Our interview with Roy Gutman was recorded last September. His reports on ethnic cleansing were collected this year in the book A Witness to Genocide. Gutman is a foreign correspondent for New York Newsday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.